Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Remember when the Bushes were the conservative Republican dynasty that Democrats love to hate? George W. Bush with his disastrous Iraq war, his Texas cowboy style, us versus them posture toward the world, torture of detainees, his tax cuts for the rich, campaign to privatize Social Security and further intertwine church and state. And there was the whole Dick Cheney thing, who left office with lower approval ratings than Trump has today. And for the father, George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, there was the controversial first Gulf War, which barely got approved by Congress, his seeming to be out of touch about a deep recession that did a lot to get Bill Clinton elected over him in 92. There was the whole Willie Horton thing, the template for a whole generation of race-baiting campaign commercials that have been running in New York and New Jersey these last few weeks, Virginia too, picking Dan Quayle as his vice president, a favorite of the religious right, further elevating that movement into the executive branch. Bush himself was anti-abortion rights to the dismay of his wife, Barbara Bush. And finally, his pardoning of Iran-Contra scandal figures, possibly giving the cover of precedent to Donald Trump for something similar in the near future. But all that seems to be forgiven by Democrats now that the Bushes refused to vote for Trump. The elder Bush actually voted for Hillary Clinton. The younger one recently gave a speech lamenting the nativism in the land today and called Trump's inaugural address some weird SH. Of course, HW, now 93, has also been in the news recently for grabbing women's rear ends and maybe more at photo ops and other public settings while making a joke that his favorite Dickens book is David Copperfield. He was forced to apologize after the Harvey Weinstein scandal pushed his own behavior into the public eye. Well, now comes a new book by possibly the leading historian of the first Bush presidency, Jeffrey Engel, director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. It's called When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. Professor Engel, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, good to talk to you.
And we'll get to that list of Democratic grievances with 41 and how they hold up under the weight of history. But it was a heady time. The fall of communism and China's Tiananmen Square massacre in Bush's first year in office, Iraq invading Kuwait during a second year. Was there a Bush doctrine of any kind that guided his approach to a post-Cold War world, or was it so new and unexpected that he was largely responding to events?
No, there really was a Bush doctrine. And one of the things that's fascinating about it is that it doesn't sound new, and it didn't sound new at the time. I mean, Bush is, of course, the president who was accused of having no vision. But the real problem with his vision is that it was the vision of Franklin Roosevelt in 1945, the vision of the international community coming together and working cooperatively to protect sovereignty and to protect international commerce and protect international security in a way that was completely circumvented by the Cold War. So the Bush doctrine in many ways is let's keep going with the things we know are good, American primacy being first and foremost, and especially with the Cold War ending, we can finally get a chance to do it the way we wanted.
You credit Bush with being the father of a unified Germany after the Berlin Wall came down. How could he be so influential from over here when the mass movement was truly grassroots over there?
Well, the grassroots movement in Germany is what brought the wall down and is in many ways what set up the conditions for subsequent policymakers, President Bush, Helmut Kohl, the leader of Germany, Margaret Thatcher, all these people to essentially figure out, okay, now what is the map going to actually look like for Europe? How are we going to actually integrate two countries? We've frankly never done this before. And what's fascinating is that we now know that everybody essentially on the international stage was against German unification except the Germans and George Bush. And George Bush's reason was really because he thought it was best for the United States, that he thought NATO was a prerequisite for American influence in Europe, which he thought was vital, and NATO could not exist without a unified Germany. So he looked at the strategic scene and said, we need to help the Germans get what they want so we can get what we want.
There was supposed to be a peace dividend after we spent so much money on global military affairs during the two superpowers era of the Cold War. That was a term that was around after communism collapsed, the peace dividend and spending on domestic items. Suddenly here we were, the only superpower, and yet we went into this big ground war barely a year later in Iraq. How hard a decision was that for President Bush after Iraq invaded Kuwait?
It was initially a very difficult decision because what ultimately happens in the Gulf War, of course, is the largest military operation for the United States overseas since the Vietnam War. And remember, we're talking about only 15 years after the Vietnam War, so there's still a heavy legacy and hangover there. There's not a lot of enthusiasm for the American people to go overseas.
And we forget, because that has a reputation, deserved or not, as the good Iraq War.
Correct.
Compared to the second one, that the vote in Congress, the vote in the Senate, was very close whether to pass a resolution authorizing that war or endorsing that war. It was not so close for the George W. Bush Iraq War.
No, in fact, it was only by a handful of votes in 1991 that Congress gave its final authorization. But it's really interesting now that we have all the documents and can see into the archives, we know it was a very, very difficult decision for George Bush to make, to put troops into the Middle East, to try to defend Saudi Arabia, to then subsequently liberate Kuwait. Very difficult decision that took several days. But then once it was made, there was no going back for him. And I think the issue of the congressional vote is actually really much more interesting now than we ever knew, because it's very clear that Bush was willing to go to war even if Congress had voted against the resolution. And his argument was essentially, we're pretty sure we're going to win this war quickly, which of course is what happened, and let's just see Congress try to impeach me after I've got a 90% approval rating.
I think there's a legend out there that says Margaret Thatcher, British Prime Minister, put the spine in George W. Bush about Iraq. Is that true?
No, it's actually not true. It's one of those. It's a story that sounds as good as though it should be true. George Bush was actually scheduled to meet with Margaret Thatcher the day after the Iraqi invasion. They had already pre-scheduled to meet in Aspen, and they met out there. And then subsequently, because Margaret Thatcher is, of course, the Iron Lady, who, of course, there's no balking in her talking in any way, she gave the impression that she essentially had bucked up Bush, but he'd already come to the decision on his own.
My guest is presidential historian Jeffrey Engel. His new book is When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. And we can take phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I'll be honest, I lived through those years, and I tend to think history is being much too kind to H.W. Bush these days. For example, I tend to think the first Gulf War was unnecessary, a war for cheap oil prices, primarily maybe seen as necessary through the biased lens, perhaps, of the Houston oil industry leaders who Bush was close to, including his Secretary of State, James Baker. If we had let the Arabs fight among themselves, maybe there wouldn't have even been a 9/11. No less a degrading of America's moral standing in the world through the way W went at it. Do you really think the first Gulf War was smart leadership by George H.W. Bush? I think your book mostly portrays it as such.
You know, I do. And in fact, I think it's really fascinating. Again, I hate to keep saying this, but now that we have the archival records, we know that it really was not necessarily about oil itself. Because if it had simply been about oil, the administration was hearing voices, Dick Cheney's voice, and other people, Colin Powell's voice, in the first couple of days suggesting, and I got to walk you through the logic here, suggesting that given that Iraq had invaded Kuwait to get oil, to sell on the open market because Iraq had incredible debts after the Iran-Iraq war, the invasion actually would depress global oil markets and oil prices. So if you really only cared about cheap oil, you should let the Iraqis just do what they want and sell it on the market. But instead, Bush came to a deeper consideration, a larger consideration, which really made the Gulf War the end of the Cold War, and to really argue that we need to stand up to aggression, not necessarily because it's bad, though that's a good reason in and of itself, but because we don't want to set a precedent for allowing aggression in other areas.
What are these archives that you got access to?
So we actually had a 10-year project at the George Bush Presidential Library, Bush 41, to essentially get everything that we could from the National Security realm declassified. And of course, as you know, the declassification process in this country, the entire confidential security process of this country, is entirely broken when it comes to documents. I'd like to say our country has a national fetish with secrecy, so much so that almost everything should be released, but is not. So consequently, at the end of 10 years, we essentially had offered and applied for more documents to be released in our project than at all the other presidential libraries combined. And consequently, we have gotten tens of thousands of new documents out, and there are still tens of thousands more to come.
So tell me a story. Give us a tidbit that I haven't asked you about.
Well, actually, you know, you referenced it before. One of the most fascinating documents for me is the very first National Security Council meeting after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. Now, it was difficult because for me as a researcher because all of the other national security meetings have been released, but not this one, not the first one, which you think would actually be the most interesting one. And it turns out it was classified, and we finally got it. And it was probably classified for a very good reason because, of course, remember, we're dealing with a time when George W. Bush was in office for the most part during this project. And as a consequence, several of the people involved in the W. administration were, of course, in the room in that first national security meeting, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, and they essentially were arguing that perhaps we shouldn't do anything about the invasion. Perhaps we don't really care about the Kuwaitis. Perhaps, again, oil is all we care about. If that's the case, why do anything at all? So basically, it's confirmation of the idea that the administration's first response was one of bewilderment, because, of course, they did not necessarily expect this invasion until the last minute. Ultimately, they come to a different conclusion, but it didn't necessarily put current policymakers in a good light.
So they undid the invasion of Kuwait militarily, but then did not go all the way to Baghdad and remove Saddam Hussein. Either decision at that time would have been controversial. Too much slaughter of innocents to get to the capital versus not a decisive enough outcome to prevent further aggression by aggressive Saddam Hussein. How close a decision was that for President Bush?
That actually was not a close decision at all. And I think for two reasons. The first is, and here I'm going to reference something that James Baker, who was Bush's Secretary of State, said. He said, people used to ask me all the time why we didn't go to Baghdad, why we didn't occupy Iraq. He said around 2005, 2006, people stopped asking because the people in the first Bush administration recognized that when you occupy a country, you own it and you have to operate and you have to rebuild it. And that was not something that they thought would be tenable. And they didn't think, frankly, that for all the reasons that we subsequently saw play out, they didn't think that the local population would ever accept America's presence. So they didn't want to grab a hold of that wasp nest. The second reason is actually more interesting to me. It's because every single intelligence agency in the world, including ours, was predicting that Saddam Hussein's lifespan at that point would not be measured in days, but in hours. There is every reason to think that one of his own people is going to take him out for embarrassing. So if you're really concerned about Saddam Hussein, it's 99.9% sure that somebody's going to take care of this problem for you.
In fact, as I understand history, and tell me if you address this in the book, because I don't know, Bush withdrew but left the Kurds, at least, with the impression that we would somehow back up attempts to overthrow Saddam internally, but we didn't. And there was another Saddam Hussein massacre post-war. Did that happen that way, as you understand the history now?
Yes, this is actually very obviously a very unfortunate case, and it's actually one that repeats itself throughout history. Many times during the Cold War and then after, of course, most especially Hungary in 1956, American presidents, by suggesting quietly or overtly that we support people uprising and coming up and seizing their own future, that we will support them, and the people on the ground interpret the word support to mean troops or arms or supplies, when what we really are talking about is moral support. It's really a great example of how a president's words reverberate across the entire international spectrum and are heard differently by different people around the world. So that is clearly a case, the Kurdish case, where people heard something that Bush did not intend to say, which is not to say that they misheard him, but he did not intend to say that. And the massacre, of course, was something which they tried to alleviate subsequently, but only after many deaths had occurred.
My guest is presidential historian Jeffrey Engel. His new book, When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. And Chandra in Ossining, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chandra.
Good morning, Brian and guests. Recently, they called it the Arab Spring. I wanted to ask, was there an issue with Saddam Hussein accusing Kuwait of slant drilling to steal his oil reserves and threatened to go? He went to the UN and threatened to invade Kuwait if he was not remunerated for his, for his oil. I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you very much. I guess slant drilling would be that it allowed Kuwait to get under Iraqi territory, and therefore take some of their oil. So on that, and even more broadly, did Saddam Hussein have any legitimate grievance with Kuwait that precipitated the invasion?
You know, the slant drilling is a difficult question because it most likely was occurring. But then again, there was a lot of things occurring on both sides of that border in that region. What's really more fundamental for driving Saddam Hussein's concern is the fact that from his perspective, he had just spent the last 8 years at war with Iran. And remember, we're talking about now the fundamental difference between Shiism and Sunniism. Basically, he saw himself as the barrier, the frontier, the blockade between the crazy Iranians who are trying to export their revolution and the rest of the Middle East. So from his perspective, he thought he had essentially given up blood and treasure, and the rest of the Arab world, the Kuwaitis especially, should pay up for the sacrifices that he had made. And what's really important to remember as well is that Saddam Hussein had actually made these kinds of threats before in the past. Every time he made these kinds of threats before, people had paid up. This time, everybody expected him to pay up as well, and unfortunately, they did not. So that was what led him to decide to take an aggressive act.
We'll continue with Jeffrey Engel and more of your calls right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Jeffrey Engel, director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University and author of a new book called When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. You write that today's Russian-American tensions, which are obviously so front and center, date to the H.W. Bush period, partly over the potential expansion of NATO. This was before Putin was very powerful. If NATO was a Cold War defense coalition, why wasn't it unnecessary provocation by the only remaining superpower, us, to get into Russia's kitchen like that when it was disintegrating anyway?
Well, the real getting into Russia's kitchen, of course, occurs later, of course, under the Clinton administration, under the George W. Bush administration, when new countries who had previously been part of the Soviet Union wind up joining NATO. Bush's rationale for wanting NATO to survive is simply because he thought the United States needed to have a presence in Europe. But the real essence of why the Russians are upset with the United States and upset with the West in particular boils down to two issues that relate to the expansion of NATO. The first is that from their perspective, we like to think of the United States that we won the Cold War. From their perspective, they gave up. It's a different equation entirely, that they gave up and they said, let's stop the arms race. This is a Russian speaking. Let's go through with a new democratic reformation. Let's join the West. Let's move into a new world. And from their perspective, it didn't happen. The 1990s were a period of extraordinary economic decline and misery in Russia. Simultaneously, the Russians believed that they had essentially a handshake agreement with the Bush administration that NATO would not expand. Two problems with that. The first is, it was only a handshake agreement. And the documentation is very clear now that the handshake agreement essentially was given, but it was never written down. It was never codified in treaty, which, of course, subsequently means the next administration is not bound in any way by the handshakes of the previous administration. So all the expansion that occurred subsequently and the economic decline that occurred subsequently and political upheaval that occurred subsequently essentially made Russians believe that their giving up at the end of the Cold War was a terrible tragedy.
And how about China? Both Bushes and Bill Clinton were bent on having more open borders trade with China, enough that H.W. Bush was willing to overlook the Tiananmen Square massacre to urge China's continued most favored nation trade status. And Clinton picked it up and did away with the annual designations altogether and eased China's way into the World Trade Organization. As you know, Trump and Steve Bannon and even Bernie Sanders considered that sequence of events one of the ruinous things on behalf of the investor class to their benefit, but not to the benefit of the American middle class. How do you treat that in the book?
Well, really, to understand the Bush's response to China, we have to take a real 30,000-foot perspective on what he believed. He had served in China. He had served around the world. He had been ambassador de facto to China. And he fundamentally believed that the democratic movements that we saw in 1989 were the direct product of the interaction that China had had with the world, the engagement that China had had with the world after the Cultural Revolution, that essentially when you engage the rest of the world, people naturally want democratic freedoms. So he looked at Tiananmen Square as a tragedy, to be sure, but as he wanted to be a step back, not a reverse course. So even though there was this tragedy, he presumed that if we just keep China engaged in the rest of the world, ultimately democracy will begin to flourish in China. Now, of course, we haven't seen that to the extent that he would have desired, but at the very least, it's still an open possibility. He really believed that democracy was the wave of the future, and in places like the Middle East or in places like China, we shouldn't do necessarily anything to push that progress along because those countries need to get there on their own time.
Would he say, with 2020 hindsight, or would you, having studied the history of that era so much, that President Bush did anything that inadvertently set up the decline of the middle class that he would now regret?
You know, one of the most fascinating things about working on this book, especially finishing it up during the election of 2016, was to see how all the central issues of 2016, the deindustrialization of the country, the hollowing out of our infrastructure, frankly, the displacement of identity politics, especially among the white working class, those all existed well before H.W. Bush came on board. Those all existed in the 70s and 80s. So I think we could lay the same blame on every one of our presidents. This is one area where I would actually agree with Donald Trump, and I have to say there are very, very few of those, where the lack of investment in education, the lack of investment in infrastructure from the 1970s on is essentially what we're seeing today. It's not just one administration. It's all administrations. Going back to your point about the Cold War dividend, that is an area where I think all of the post-war presidents can really be accused of not having done more to prepare for the future.
Here's another Gulf War question, I think, from Derek on the Upper West Side. Hey, Derek, you're on WNYC.
Thanks for taking my call. I'll get right to it. I think your guest and most analysts of the first Gulf War may have been a little bit off in it that Saddam's motivation and primary objective may not have been so much as to get the Kuwaiti oil, but to eliminate the debt. During the 8-year Iran-Iraq war, propagated and supported by the U.S. via Donald Rumsfeld, he was in debt to Kuwait for $75 billion and to Saudi Arabia for $125 billion. Ergo, once he invaded Kuwait, he immediately wiped out his debt. You don't have to pay debt to somebody who no longer exists. Anything after that was basically gravy. That is, stealing their wealth because they were the richest country in per capita, and taking whatever oil they could take. But immediately, once he took their government, he didn't have to pay back the $75 billion debt. Plus,
therefore, Derek, very briefly, does that argue to you that the war was unnecessary?
I didn't say unnecessary. I mean, when you say necessary, you mean necessary to whom? If he knocked out his debt, then that was, I think, yes, his primary interest. And here's the part I was trying to get to. He owed $125 billion to Saudi Arabia. The big fear was, since he knocked out Kuwait, maybe he would go over to Saudi Arabia, which he owed 40% more, and knock them out. And if you remember, Osama bin Laden saw the same relationship,
right,
and volunteered, I think, 15,000 men to defend the holy sites of Mecca, Medina, from what Al-Qaeda believed was an imminent invasion threat from Iraq.
That's right. Derek, thank you. So since we just have 90 seconds left, I guess we're going to finish on this point. But one of the things that seemed to radicalize Osama bin Laden the most was U.S. troops being stationed in Saudi Arabia permanently after the Gulf War. How much do you think Bush's deployment there, which Clinton kept and doubled down on in certain ways, was a miscalculation of risk that helped give us 9/11?
That's a great question. And I think fundamentally it is undoubtedly true that the presence of American troops in Saudi Arabia is one of the primary motivators for Osama bin Laden and his followers to become radicalized against the West. That being said, it's when we talk about international consequences, it's obviously the policymakers' requirement to think about what might happen down the road. But Osama bin Laden was not really on anybody's radar necessarily in 1990-91. He was a person people knew, but he wasn't the threat that obviously he became. So I think that they were justified in making that decision without worrying about 20 years later, would people be radicalized by our presence when they presumed their presence was there to help?
George H.W. Bush, you write, was arguably the most experienced person elected president in the 20th century. Just in 20 seconds, he's quoted in another new book calling Trump a blowhard, based partly on Trump's response to a question about who his foreign policy advisors would be. Trump said, myself, I talk about those things a lot.
Yeah, Bush was the most experienced person, honestly, that we've ever had in the White House, certainly in the 20th century. And one of the things that was impressive about him was that he was willing to listen to others and engage others and take information behind the scenes and publicly to try to make the best decisions, no matter how it affected his poll numbers.
Presidential historian Jeffrey Engel's new book is called When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. Thank you so much.
Good to talk to you.